Hi, and welcome to In the News on Chris. I'm Steve Sacco. Today I'll be reading from Time Magazine, the September 30th, 2024 edition of Time Magazine. And this week we're going to start with Trump Stumped. The former frontrunner is struggling to adjust to Kamala Harris. And this is by Brian Bennett, Eric Cortalesa, and Philip Elliott. The two candidates for president of the United States are as different as any duo in history. A billionaire businessman versus a career prosecutor and politician. A son of a privilege against the daughter of a middle-class single mother. One reckless, one cautious. A former commander-in-chief against the first black and southern Asian woman to claim the nomination. They hail from different coasts, different generations, different tax brackets. But as stark as the choice facing American voters this September may be, the nation has never gotten a glimpse of Donald Trump and Kamala Harris side by side before they squared off in Philadelphia on September 10th, in what may be their sole debate before Election Day. For the Republican, the United States is a hellscape of rising crime, unchecked immigration, and economic misery. For the Democrat, the nation is beset by the division Trump has sowed, the abortion bans he has ushered in, and the economic policies he's passed that favor the rich at the expense of the rest. But beyond the canned salvos and campaign boilerplate, the high-stakes clash underscored how dramatically the presidential race has changed since midsummer. When even top Democrats conceded, Trump appeared to be sailing to victory in his rematch with President Joseph Biden. As plain as it is that Trump wishes he were still running against Biden, it's equally apparent that Harris has rattled him. The split screen said it all. Trump glowered and grimaced, spewing old grievances and strange new attacks. The former president repeated a baseless internet rumor that migrant invaders were killing and eating dogs and cats in Springfield, Ohio, and claimed that Harris wants to do transgender operations on illegal aliens in prison. With sharp riposts and canny traps, Harris baited Trump into boasting about his crowd sizes, grousing about the 2020 election, and standing up for the rioters who attacked the U.S. Capitol to thwart the peaceful transfer of power. In the 9 years since Trump first burst onto the scene, no opponent, Democrat or Republican, has dealt with the 800-pound gorilla of American politics as coolly or gotten under his skin to such a degree. Which is how it has been going for Trump for a while now. Despite weeks of speculation that Harris was poised to replace Biden at the top of the ticket, Trump and his campaign were caught flat-footed, left lurching from one attack line to another. More than once, top aides thought they had settled on a strategy, only to see the candidate himself upend it on the fly. According to a person close to Trump, the level of campaign infighting and backstabbing rivaled the 2016 operation, an infamous snake pit. Facing a new opponent, Trump reverted to his old ways. In a matter of weeks, Trump frittered away his commanding position. Harris's smooth debate galvanized the Democratic base and unlocked a fundraising behemoth that dwarfed that of Trump and his allies. In the handful of pivotal swing states, her campaign is building on formidable operations that she inherited from Biden, and boasts a striking advantage in cash and reserved ad time between now and Election Day. I think everyone was caught off guard by the way it shifted so dramatically, says a person close to Trump. For all that, the debate arrived with the race deadlocked. The polls showed Trump and Harris effectively tied across the battleground states, with both sides of the electorate more enthusiastic about voting this fall than they were earlier this year. Despite her deft consolidation of power and surge of support, Harris remained undefined for many Americans. And for all his late summer stumbles, Trump was in a stronger position than at the stage of the race in either 2016 or 2020. The biggest variable in the final weeks of the campaign may be Trump's trademark indiscipline. The campaign operation that brought him to his peak in July remains in place, augmented by later rivals more inclined to let Trump be Trump. The candidate himself has cut deals for support with once unlikely allies like Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and Elon Musk, and continues to test new attacks against Harris in search of one that will stick. Either he will become only the second president to win back the White House after defeat, or he will author one of the most dramatic political collapses of modern times. Less than 24 hours before everything changed, an exuberant Trump stood on a rally stage in Grand Rapids, Michigan, cracking jokes next to his new running mate, J.D. Vance. Trump asked attendees if they'd rather he run against Biden or Harris. The crowd cheered their preference for Biden, who was at that moment huddled with advisors in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware, mulling an exit from the race. A day later, Biden was out, Harris was mobilized, and Trump's bravado evaporated. Behind the scenes, the former president was livid and disoriented at the abrupt turn of events. "Obviously, we had to ditch a bunch of stuff and then overnight start new attacks," says a campaign official. Trump fumed at how the media was covering Harris's entry into the race, griping that they never talk about me that way, according to a second campaign official. Trump felt like he was being punished for vanquishing his opponent 108 days too early. After a July on offense, the campaign spent August on defense, explaining away Vance's past statements about the childless cat ladies and clumsily making amends with Republican Governor Brian Kemp of Georgia, just weeks after Trump bashed him for not backing the baseless claims that the former president really won the 2020 election. Trump, who previously reduced opponents to punchlines with pithy nicknames, tried out and then ditched multiple ones for Harris. "Laughing Kamala," "Lying Kamala," "Crazy Kamala." None seemed to land like he wanted. More recently, he's favored "Comrade Kamala." "It's like a boxer with his guard up trying out jabs," says a former Trump aide. "I think it's taken him a while to get there with Kamala." As Harris gained in the polls, bringing battleground states that tilted towards Trump into a dead heat, tensions within the campaign bubbled into view. Trump brought in sharp-elbowed loyalists from his previous runs, including 2016 campaign manager Corey Lewandowski. Laura Trump, the Republican National Committee co-chair and the former president's daughter-in-law, says Chris LaCivita and Susie Wiles are still running the campaign strategy, as they have been for more than a year. The return of Lewandowski, she says, represents a revival of the scrappy character of Trump's first campaign. "He brings back some of that spunk from 2016, she says. For many Republicans, the only shift they want to see is an end to Trump's sexist and racist attacks on Harris. Trump has said world leaders would treat her like a play toy, and amplified the crude comments about her on social media that implied she had traded sexual favors to help her political career. At a gathering of black journalists, he claimed Harris only recently happened to turn black, bringing up how Harris frames her identity was a targeted effort to charge Harris as inauthentic, says one person close to Trump. He said, "Okay, no one is hitting her. I'm just going to do it myself," the person says. That explanation doesn't fly with the Republican strategists and conservative leaders, many of whom have pleaded with Trump to steer clear of such comments and focus on the issues. "Don't give people an opportunity to vote emotionally," says a frustrated GOP operative working on the Trump election campaign. The candidate appears unmoved. During an August 21st rally in Asheboro, North Carolina, he drew laughs as he mimicked his advisors telling him that, "Sir, please stick to policy, don't get personal," and joked about firing them. Podcaster Lex Fridman made one of the most direct efforts to get Trump to tone it down, telling him in an interview this month that he was more effective offering a positive vision for the future rather than criticizing the Democrats. The former president rejected the premise. "Yeah, I think you have to criticize, though," said Trump. "I think they're nasty." Many Republicans now seem more resigned to Trump doubling down on his divine strategy through Election Day. "Trump should be talking issues, not throwing personal insults all over the place," says Charlie Black, a veteran Republican strategist who was a senior advisor on John McCain's 2008 presidential campaign. "But he won't do that. He doesn't appear capable of it." In the minds of Trump defenders, the critics are looking at the situation all wrong. Trump enters the final stretch of the race with a clearer path to victory than in either of his past two campaigns. In the Real Clear Politics polling average for must-win Pennsylvania, he's tied, whereas he was down 4.3% at this point in 2020 and 6.2% in 2016. Georgia and North Carolina are effectively tied, but advisors believe he's the favorite to pull out both traditionally red states. If Trump takes those three battlegrounds, campaign officials argue the election is his. Polling in the past two elections, they note, underestimated his support. On the other hand, argues Democratic strategist Simon Rosenberg, there's been a different pattern since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in 2022. "Republicans have underperformed public polling and expectations, and we've overperformed. It's even close at this point is a cause for optimism," insists Trump confidants. This is all during Kamala's salad days, her debut, her convention, her selection of the running mate, her monster fundraising numbers, says Kellyanne Conway, a former top Trump aide who still advises him. "If you look at the metrics during the last 5 weeks, she should be leading him everywhere, and she's not." They also note some moves by the Trump campaign since Harris's entry, most prominently persuading Kennedy to drop his independent bid and endorse Trump after weeks of prodding from Donald Trump Jr. and venture capitalist Omid Malik. While Team Harris believes that Kennedy's blessing will alienate the moderate voters who recoil from the conspiracy theorist, Trump's orbit believes it will coax more voters into their column. "By him coming off the ballot in some of these places, that's a benefit to the Trump team," says Lewandowski. In the coming weeks, Trump officials told Time magazine, the campaign strategy is to continue to cast Harris as a far-left chameleon while keeping the focus on immigration, the economy, and crime, the issues on which Trump polls the best. They also intend to make better use of resources they squandered in 2020, including a vote-by-mail operation targeted to boost Republican turnout. Vance will be deployed as the disciplined policy attack dog, says a campaign official. Trump, on the other hand, has adopted a different media strategy. Interviews with podcasters who are popular amongst young men, such as Friedman, Sean Ryan, and Logan Paul. Trump may be the first major candidate to so aggressively court the frat vote, a cohort of men below the age of 30 who could tip the scales in swing states like Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. At the same time, the campaign is planning a tour of female surrogates to target suburban women voters. If the campaign wasn't as ready for Harris as it should have been in late July, says Trump ally Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, they are now. Trump's team is betting that his singular approach to politics can produce another victory. They know their strategy is vulnerable to the whims of their boss, someone who has long trusted above all his own instincts. Wiles and La Chavita may have built a disciplined operation designed to get him over the line, but in the final stretch, Trump is surrounding himself more and more with a rotating cast of loyalists who are encouraging him to embrace his impulses. But the clearest sign that Trump's bid for a return to the White House may be in trouble came after the debate ended. his top advisors claimed victory in a prepared statement hailing his masterful performance. Harris immediately asked for another showdown next month. Now let's head over to the brief. The Long Wait by Nick Popley. Judge Juan Marchand's postponement of Donald Trump's sentencing keeps the nation on hold as well. When Donald Trump in May became the first former president ever to be criminally convicted, one question was answered and a whole new set arose. Perhaps most important, would America vote this fall with the Republican presidential nominee behind bars? The answer turns out to be no, but only because his sentencing is now being postponed. Judge Juan Marchand, who oversaw Trump's criminal case in Manhattan over falsifying business records, said on September 6th that he will announce the sentence on November 26th to avoid any question of interfering with the election. Trump was supposed to learn his fate on September 18th, about 7 weeks before Election Day. Trump faces up to 4 years in prison after a 12-member jury in Manhattan unanimously pronounced him guilty of 34 felony charges. Though he could receive a lighter sentence or probation as a first-time offender. The conviction stemmed from his involvement in a scheme to cover up a $130,000 payment to former adult star Stormy Daniels just before the 2016 presidential election. Hush money meant to prevent her from affecting the outcome of the ballot by publicly discussing an alleged sexual encounter with Donald Trump. The jury found that Trump falsified business records to disguise the nature of this reimbursement. Trump's team had requested a delay in the sentencing, and it was granted without objection from the Manhattan District Attorney's Office. The defense argued that an early sentencing could unduly affect the voters' perceptions and framed the delay as a necessary measure to preserve the integrity of the election process. Marchand acknowledged the public sensitivity of the timing. Adjourning decision on the motion and sentencing, if such is required, should dispel any suggestion that the court will have issued any decision or imposed sentence either to give an advantage to or to create a disadvantage for any political party in any candidate for any office. With sentencing delayed until after the election, Trump's lawyers will have extra time to try to overturn his conviction. It'll also allow Trump to run his campaign for a second term without the possibility of doing so from prison, letting him focus on the campaign messaging without the immediate distraction of any legal proceedings. Throughout the trial, but especially in recent weeks, Judge Marchand found himself in unprecedented predicaments. At one point, imposing a gag order barring Trump from verbal attacks on witnesses. In his ruling, he said he was still striving to treat Trump as he would any other defendant, despite the extraordinary nature of the case and its potential political ramifications. Trump's campaign seized on the judge's ruling postponing sentencing as evidence that the prosecution was politically motivated. The candidate himself has repeatedly hurled insults at Marchand, whom he calls biased against him, and leveled personal attacks on the judge's daughter, a Democratic political consultant. Indeed, Trump's political fortunes surged last year as his indictment, first by the Manhattan prosecutor, a Democrat, and eventually on a total of 88 counts in four jurisdictions, nourishing a fresh narrative of politically motivated persecution that resonated with his base. In a statement posted to social media, Trump wrote, "The Manhattan DA witch hunt has been postponed because everyone realizes that there was no case. I did nothing wrong." Trump has declared that the U.S. Supreme Court's recent ruling on presidential immunity, which granted broad protection to presidential conduct, could affect his New York State case and may provide grounds to overturn the conviction. However, prosecutors have argued that the Supreme Court's ruling on immunity had no bearing on a state case related to a sex scandal cover-up before he was elected president. The evidence that he claims is affected by the Supreme Court's ruling constitutes only a sliver of the mountains of testimony and documentary proof that the jury considered in finding him guilty, according to prosecutors. Marchand is set to deliver his decision on the immunity request on September 16th, just 2 days before sentencing had been scheduled to happen. Delays has become a fixture in all Trump's criminal cases since he was indicted 4 times in 2023, with legal battles in New York, Florida, Georgia, and Washington, D.C. The Florida case involving classified documents was dismissed by a judge in July, although the special counsel is appealing that ruling. Meanwhile, the 2 January 6 related cases remain unresolved and are unlikely to progress before the election. The New York case, which was the only one to go to trial this year, concluded with Trump's guilty verdict in May. Now Trump will sidestep the potential disruption of a courtroom spectacle during the final stages of his campaign, as the voters are left to answer the one question Trump likely cares about the most. Next, we have the bulletin. India's Supreme Court orders striking doctors to return to work. India's highest court instructed striking junior doctors to return to work in a September 9th order, after weeks of protests that followed the rape and murder of a trainee medic in Kolkata. Some doctors in the state vowed to continue pressing their demands as the protests spread beyond India's borders after the order. Thousands of Indians protested on September 10th in 130 cities across 25 countries, including the United States, to demand justice, organizers told Reuters news outlet. Doctor's murder is first. The victim was a 31-year-old trainee doctor at R.G. Carr Medical College, a government-run hospital. Her severely injured body was discovered by colleagues the morning of August 9th, after she reportedly fell asleep in a seminar room during a 36-hour shift. A man was arrested for the crime on August 10th, and a Kolkata court rejected his request for bail on September 6th. Second, toll on the hospitals. The walkouts have put a strain on the country's healthcare system, particularly in the state of West Bengal. Kapil Sipal, the lawyer representing the state before the Supreme Court, claimed that at least 23 patients have died as a result of the doctors' strike. The junior doctors say they have taken the necessary precautions to prevent harm from coming to patients, including creating a new telemedicine service that launched on August 31st. And lastly, number 3, safety for the medics. A survey conducted in 2015 by the Indian Medical Association found that 75% of doctors experienced violence on the job. The West Bengal Junior Doctors Front, which spearheaded the strike effort in the region, said on September 10th that the government had failed to provide doctors with safe working conditions and vowed to continue striking despite the Supreme Court's order until their demands for justice and better hospital security were met. Dr. Arimpa Sarha, a Calcutta National Medical College junior doctor on strike, told Time magazine that she was disheartened by the court's focus on the doctor's return to work as opposed to justice for the victim. She said in a WhatsApp message that she believed that there was little discussion in the September 9th hearing about the 30 days of injustice since the murder, which she said was the reason so many doctors had taken to the streets. Next in the brief, we have roadways, cutting traffic to fight emissions. And this is by Micheline Maynard. Tourists consider Dublin to be a lively, legendary cultural hub, but for its residents and business owners, getting anywhere can be a challenge. Traffic in Dublin is absolutely appalling, says Emma Gray, the co-founder of Galileo et Gray, a cafe in one of the city's busiest areas. Multiple studies rate Dublin's traffic as the second worst among major global cities, behind only London, whose population is nearly 20 times as great. Ireland's Department of Transportation estimates that the economic cost of the traffic jams in Dublin is likely to soar from €336 million, which is $372 million, in 2022 to €1.5 billion, or $1.7 billion, by the year 2040. In February, the city announced a plan that aims for a 40% reduction in overall traffic by the year 2028. In August, Dublin launched two primary traffic lanes to city center, set up dedicated bus lines, and established pedestrian-only streets and gathering spots in an effort to encourage more people to get around the city without using cars. Dublin joined a flock of global cities that have banned or limited vehicle traffic on a regular basis. Amsterdam, Paris, Barcelona, Brussels, Helsinki, Copenhagen, and Birmingham, England are among a growing list of places that are addressing congestion and encouraging motorists to walk, bike, and use transit. A key goal is to reduce carbon dioxide and other emissions that pose a danger to people and the environment. Hundreds of cities and countries have joined a United Nations-led drive to achieve net zero carbon emissions by the year 2050. According to the UN, urban areas consume more than two-thirds of the world's energy and account for more than 70% of global carbon dioxide emissions. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has said that cities were where the climate battle will largely be won or lost. Paris, the site of a landmark conference in 2015, focused on the environment, saying that it has been making progress for years. In 2007, it adopted the Plan Climat, which in 11 years reduced its carbon footprint by 20% and cut greenhouse gases by 25%. By the year 2050, the city aims to achieve zero emissions within its borders and shrink its total carbon footprint by 80%. Some of its steps include solar panels and, most noticeably by visitors, bike lanes across the city. Since 2001, bike thoroughfares have grown from 125 miles to more than 600 miles. At times, the bikes outnumber the motor vehicles, and there's even been bike jams at some busy intersections. For the Olympics, Paris added 34 miles of new routes in just over 2 years. In Amsterdam, where even the royal family uses bicycles, carbon emission levels have dropped by 30% since 2010, and that's according to Rory van den Berg, a spokesman for the city. Pollution levels are almost back to 1990 figures, and the city hopes to eliminate 95% of emissions by the year 2050. Meanwhile, Copenhagen is aiming to become the world's first carbon-neutral city by next year, based on a four-part plan that includes energy consumption and production, mobility measures, and administrative steps. It's reduced its carbon dioxide emissions by 80% from 2019 to 2022 by focusing on the city's heating and cooling network, which uses residual waste incineration to heat houses across the city. But business owners say environmental moves can constrict their ability to operate. In Dublin, Gray already sees an issue with the city's plan to set up the Riverside Corridors, one which is near her cafe. Currently, it does not provide for loading zones, something she pointed out in a response to the upcoming regulations. Without a place for our deliveries to stop, this could be a major problem for us, she says. For instance, a nearby family business that specializes in glazing and glass cutting won't be able to function without regular deliveries of plate glass. The fear is that without consideration to local businesses, we will all just move out of the city, says Gray. And that's a crucial consideration. Small and medium-sized businesses account for more than 90% of businesses worldwide and employ more than 50% of workers. In emerging economies, they provide up to 40% of the GDP, according to the World Bank. Still, there's a sense that despite the obstacles, change is inevitable. More bikes and spaces for cyclists and more green space and less cars are the way forward, says Gray. Well, that's all the time we have for today. I've been reading from Time Magazine, the September 30th, 2024 edition of Time Magazine. I'm Steve Sacco. So long until next time.